Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35,000ths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. "No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit." I mean, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post. And the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't see her.
Find yourself. You from New State.
It's over. Everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
I ain't caught it. I'll smack the fuck out of one of y'all. Real quick. Just like this one as well.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you can do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity, and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did, by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police, like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavored Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning when the sun didn't shine. I picked up my shovel and I walked to the mine. I loaded 16 tons of number 9 coal, and the straw boss said, well, to bless my soul, you load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning, it was drizzling rain. Fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raised in the canebrake by an old mama lion. Can't know a high-toned woman make me walk the line. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. If you see me coming, better step aside. A lot of men didn't, a lot of men died. One fist of iron, the other of steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
My home is not for sale, and if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe.
What Jim Salee is talking about is the city of Lakewood, Ohio, taking his house, his home, through eminent domain to make way for a high-priced condo that will pay the city more in taxes than he and his wife Joanne do. And he says he's not going to take it lying down.
It's a close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
I'm Mike Wallace.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Ed Bradley.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl. Those stories and Andy Rooney tonight on 60 Minutes.
Just about everyone knows that under a process called eminent domain, the government can and does seize private property for public use to build a road or a courthouse. But did you know the government can also seize your land for private use if they can prove that doing it will serve what is called the public good? Cities across the country have been using eminent domain to force people off their land so that private developers can build more expensive homes and offices, which will pay more in property taxes than the buildings they are replacing. Under eminent domain, the government buys your property, paying you what is determined to be fair market value. But now, people who don't want to sell their homes at any price just to see their land go to another private owner are fighting back.
The bottom line is, this is morally wrong, what they're doing here. This is our home. and we're going to stay here, and I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
Jim and Joanne Salida refusing to sell the home they've lived in for 38 years in a quiet neighborhood of single-family houses in Lakewood, Ohio, just outside Cleveland. The city of Lakewood is trying to use eminent domain to force the Salidas out to make way for more expensive condominiums. But the Salidas are in effect telling the town, hell no, they won't go.
We talked about this when we were dating. I used to point to the houses and say, Joanne, one of these days we're going to have one of these houses. And I meant it. And I worked hard.
What'd you do?
I worked in the pharmaceutical industry. And we worked very hard for this and paid it off. And we said, oh, we've got it. We paid off our home. I retired. And now we're going to spend the rest of our days here and pass this on to our children.
But Lakewood's mayor, Madeline Kane, has other plans. She wants to tear down the Salidas home, plus 55 homes around it, along with four apartment buildings and more than a dozen businesses, so that private developers can build high-priced condominiums and a high-end shopping mall, and thus raise Lakewood's property tax base.
This is a project.
The mayor told us she sought out a developer for the project because Lakewood's aging tax base has been shrinking, and the city simply needs more money.
This is about Lakewood's future. Lakewood cannot survive without a strengthened tax base. Is it right to consider this a public good? Absolutely.
What you're saying effectively is that the Salidas neighborhood has to be sacrificed for the greater good of the city of Lakewood.
I guess I'm saying that that neighborhood is being asked to, and it's difficult and it's unfortunate that they are being asked to give up their home.
They want this whole area because of the view of the park.
Well, it's a beautiful view.
It is an awesome view. They know it's gorgeous, and they want it. It's that simple.
This whole area is called Scenic Park, but that's the problem. Because it is so scenic, it's a prime place to build upscale condominiums. With great views over the Rocky River, those condos will be a cinch to sell.
But the condos can't go up unless the city can remove the Salidas and their neighbors through eminent domain. And to legally invoke eminent domain, the city had to certify that this scenic park area is really, quote, blighted.
We're not blighted. This is an area that we absolutely love. This is a close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And, Mike, you don't know how humiliating this is to have people tell you you live in a blighted area. And how degrading this is.
You're the mayor. You know the place. Tell me what is blighted about that area.
The term blighted is a statutory word. It is. It really doesn't have a lot to do with whether or not your home is painted. It is a legal statutory term.
Meaning?
That is used to describe an area. And the question is whether or not that area can be used for a higher and better use.
What does that mean, a higher and better use? What's higher and better than a home?
The term blight is used to describe whether or not the structures generally in an area meet today's standards.
And it's the city that sets those standards. So Lakewood set a standard for blight that would include most of the homes in the neighborhood. A home could be considered blighted if it doesn't have the following.
3 bedrooms, 2 baths, an attached 2-car garage, and central air. Now this community is over 100 years old. Who has all those things?
You mean it's blighted if it doesn't have 3 bedrooms?
Those things I just told you. That's the criteria. And it's ridiculous.
You don't have central air.
No, and we don't need it because of the air. We always have a breeze.
Sure.
Right off Lake Erie, the breeze comes right through here all the time. We counted all the attached garages in Lakewood. There's 20 in the whole city.
We counted 20.
And by the way, we got up at a meeting and told the mayor and all 7 council members their houses are blighted according to this criteria.
My understanding is that using the criteria that are in place, more than 90% of the houses in Lakewood could be deemed blighted, including the houses of the mayor and of every one of the city council members. True? Do you have two bathrooms?
No.
Blight. Two-car garage?
No.
Blight. Is the garage attached?
No.
Blight. And your lot size is under 5,000 square feet?
Oh, well under.
You've called that area a cute little neighborhood. You didn't call it a cute little blighted neighborhood. I mean, you and I know that it's not a blighted neighborhood.
I would never personally walk that neighborhood and indicate that that neighborhood is not attractive or... I mean, I would never say that.
It's a cute little neighborhood.
It is a cute little neighborhood. You'll get me to say it on the record. It is a cute little neighborhood.
Cute? Maybe, but without those new condos, it won't produce enough property taxes to satisfy the mayor and the city council.
That's no excuse for taking my home. My home is not for sale, and if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe in the whole country, not only Ohio, but this is rampant all over the country. It's like a plague.
This is a nationwide epidemic. We have documented more than 10,000 instances of government taking property from one person to give it to another in just the last 5 years.
Dana Berliner and Scott Bullock are attorneys at a libertarian nonprofit group called the Institute for Justice, which has filed suit on behalf of the Salites against the city of Lakewood. They claim that taking private property this way is unconstitutional.
It is fundamentally wrong and contrary to the Constitution for the government to take property from one private owner and hand it over to another private owner just because the government thinks that person is going to make more productive use of the land.
Everyone knows that property can be taken for a road, but nobody thinks that property can be taken to give it to their neighbor or the large business down the street for their economic benefit. People are shocked when they hear that this is going on around the country.
And it's not just people's homes that are the targets in these eminent domain cases. The Institute for Justice has also filed suit against the city of Mesa, Arizona, to save Randy Bailey's brake repair shop, the shop he got from his father and hopes someday to pass on to his son. The city of Mesa, citing the need for redevelopment, is trying to force Bailey to relocate to make way for an Ace Hardware store that would look better and pay more taxes.
Redevelopment to me is, work with the existing people there and redevelop.
Right.
Not, you get out, we're bringing this guy in.
Bailey's Brake Service has been on this corner for more than 30 years.
In Mesa, this is the corner, Main Street and Country Club. There's not a better corner in this city.
And business has been pretty good down the years?
Business has been awesome.
Now, what used to be in all of this property? I mean, everything else has disappeared.
The city come in and got immediate possession and started demolishing it, making it dirt.
The city has made dirt out of 3 restaurants and 4 businesses that once stood on this 5-acre lot.
And it's not just business properties that they're doing this on. You know, they wiped out 8 people's homes over here. You know, your home ain't even safe.
Bailey told us his neighbors let the city buy them out. But he's refusing to sell.
I'm standing in their way. I'm their thorn in their side.
The thorn in the side of Ken Linhart, who owns the Ace Hardware store a few blocks away. Linhart wants a much bigger store. He could have negotiated with Bailey, but instead, he convinced the city of Mesa to try to buy Bailey's land through eminent domain and then sell it to him.
The city of Mesa wants to move Mr. Bailey about a block away. And from what I understand, it's going to be a new building, new equipment, moving expenses, and everything set up for him. I don't see how Mr. Bailey's going to get hurt.
You can't replace a business in the same location. This place was built in 1952 as a break and front end shop. I don't care where you move into City Mesa, it would never be the same.
So Bailey went to Linhart looking for a way to stay on his corner.
I tried to go to him and see if we couldn't work something out on this. And he told me, no, there ain't room for you there. We're going to let the city just take care of you.
Did you ever sit down and try to negotiate with him?
No, I never did.
Redevelopment seems to me to make obvious good sense. But the right of eminent domain to take one man's private property, Randy Bailey, to give it, in effect, to Ken Linhart for his private property.
It happens all over the country. Practically any town you want to go to, they're redeveloping their town centers.
Right.
Now, Are we going to sit in Mesa, Arizona, and have our town center decay? As a citizen of Mesa, I don't want that to happen.
If I'd had a for sale sign out there, it'd been a whole different deal. And for them to come in and tell me how much my property is worth, and for me to get out because they're bringing in somebody else, when I own the land, is unfounded to me. It don't even sound like the United States.
And this isn't happening just in small towns. Right here in New York City, a few blocks away from Times Square, New York State has forced a man to sell land on that corner over there that his family had owned for more than 100 years. And what's going up instead? A courthouse? A school? Nope. The new headquarters of the New York Times.
It seems the world's most prestigious newspaper wants to build a new home on this block. But Stratford Wallace and the block's other property owners did not want to sell. Wallace told us the newspaper never tried to negotiate with him. Instead, the Times teamed up with a major real estate developer, and together they convinced the state to use eminent domain to force Wallace out by declaring the block blighted.
I challenge them. This is not blighted property, nor is this property over here blighted.
But New York State Supreme Court disagreed. The court ruled that the newspaper's new headquarters would eliminate blight, and that even though a private entity, the New York Times, is the main beneficiary, improving the block would benefit the public. New York Times executives would not talk to us about it on camera. Back in Lakewood, Ohio, Jim and Joanne Salid are still waiting for their court decision. Most of their neighbors have agreed to sell if the project goes ahead, but the Salids plus a dozen others are hanging tough.
I thought I bought this place, but I guess I just leased it until the city wants it. That's what makes me very angry. This is my dream home, and I'm going to fight for it.
Now the fight is moving to the ballot box. Lakewood residents opposed to the development have gathered enough signatures to force a citywide referendum on it come November.
Okay. All right. We're starting not a tad bit, late today. With It's My House. But today's podcast is titled The Millionaire Philosophy. And this is the last Friday of the month, I believe. Last Friday of the year. Last Friday of 2019. So today's podcast is titled The Millionaire Philosophy. And Robin, are you there?
I am here. Hello, everyone.
Yeah, thanks for sticking around. First thing, there's some definitions of millionaire online, but I don't like them. The way they're defining millionaire is one who has little or no money, period, end of story. But I don't like that definition because it doesn't say anything about resourcefulness, how to operate without money.
And they actually got that. I've been teaching on the millionaire concept, oh my goodness, about 10 years now. So now you have people taking excerpts of the definition and they don't have it. You're right, they don't have it right. Millionaire thinking, millionaire, it comes from having it might seem like you have nothing. Like I was in a homeless situation. No job, no place to stay, no money, no food. I mean, not. And it seemed like I had nothing. But when I looked around, there were all kind of opportunities that I could.
And resources.
You know, yes, and resources. Yeah. Yeah. And so to me, a millionaire comes from the word no, which means nothing, right?
Right.
Or, and like you, in the games, you bid nil, you go a blind nil, Nielsen, nil, right?
Right.
So millionaire, that's where millionaire comes from. Correct. And it's also taking that and coming up and overcoming and generating income from seemingly nothing. And it's not necessarily income is not necessarily money. Okay.
Right.
If we're going to be on this show for thinking in terms of off the grid, you got to throw money off the grid too. And it's not only just other people's money, but money period. Because you need to realize that people are the currency. We are the currency, not the dollars. I'll give you give you an example. Let's say your hot water heater goes out and it floods your place, and you gotta get out of there while they're repairing it and stay in a hotel. And so insurance will cover it, but you have to pay out of pocket and they'll reimburse you. Well, I don't have the money to give you to stay in the hotel and you ain't got it, but I'm going out of town this weekend. So you can come stay over at my house. And hey, since I'm not going anywhere, the car's in the garage, so you'll have transportation. Boom. Now we've just done, probably about $1,000 exchange, and neither one of us have exchanged a dime, 10 cents, because right. We are the currency. Does that make sense to you?
It does.
People are the
currency. Example. Another would be, if I got this from you, it helped me out. I got a... one of my regular telephone providers.
Yes.
A large bill. And I've got, on that particular provider, I'm not going to mention their name, but it's big. They're bigger bills, but they're smaller bills, but this is big. So, you told me what to do, which was go download this particular app.
Yes.
And now I've got new service, a new phone number. And new service, just as good as the other people, at least so far that's what I'm thinking, and the ability to do unlimited calls and unlimited texts for nil. Now, they got a premium. That might be, right now I don't need that. So thank you again.
Cool.
So if you want to share with us, because that's part of that millionaire thinking too. The philosophy.
Correct. So the one of the things that I took away from the audio portion is ownership. If you create something and if you build something, then there's no question about the ownership. Okay? And so and you always want to create the opportunity. I think I'm about to forget the question you just asked me. Okay. So one of the things using the millionaire concept is you can, with the digital concept and with applications and the internet and digital and all that, you can create bandwidth within already existing bandwidth, which I specialize in doing. And so I discovered, actually I didn't discover it, my daughter told me about this company called TextNow, where you can go on, enter in your email, and they'll give you a free phone number for whatever area code you want. Okay? And while you can get a phone and a cellular service through them, You don't have to. You can use their Wi-Fi, the service's Wi-Fi, as long as you're connected to the internet. Okay? And then also, if you don't have a phone, you can log into the web and place calls and receive calls right through the browser. You don't even have to have a phone. And then if you did get a premium phone with them or a premium account with them, and let's say for whatever reason you lapsed in payment or whatever, you won't lose your phone number. It just reverts back to a free account. So if you're...
Now, what's the premium call? What's the cost for premium on this particular app?
They have... Okay, now the premium they have for the Wi-Fi side, you can pay like $2 and reserve your number, you know, and no ads on the application.
Okay.
And then you can also go shop and actually purchase a phone and get cellular service through them too, with different data plan, with the common plans as the other carriers. Uh-huh.
Okay.
So you have the ability to get a cellular service and phone through them, you know, or you can stay on a free Wi-Fi. And if you don't, you don't have to have a phone. You just have to have an email address, because you can log into the web, the browser, Chrome, Firefox, whatever, and place and receive calls online. So if you're a person that's homeless and you don't even have an Obama phone, because believe it or not everybody qualifies for an Obama phone. So there's still a lot of people that are disconnected. Mm-hmm. So if you're homeless, you don't have a phone, you don't have a computer or whatever, you can still go to the library and log on. And if the signal's not strong enough to place or receive calls, you still have voicemail and text messages. I mean, it's awesome. So this is a solution. You're pulling from, it seems like nothing. If you look at it, it looks like it's just another common app. But then when you get right into the functionalities of it, it's like, hey, whoa, hey, now this is a solution. And then you can be off the grid. You don't have to have a cellular plan. All you have to do is just get connected to the Wi-Fi. And there's a lot of cities and towns that are providing free Wi-Fi coverage citywide. Federal Way is one of them. Tacoma, Washington is one of them. You walk outside and there's just free Wi-Fi, you know? So.
And there's also Facebook own WhatsApp app.
Facebook phone is awesome. And also people can do banking. You can transmit, you can send and receive money in Facebook as well. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right.
You can link several of your debit cards and payment cards to your Facebook and then send and receive money right there. Facebook is becoming an awesome little machine over there for that. I'm going to figure out a way to offer that service. Mm-hmm.
Right.
On my site. Yeah.
Any other practical ways that we can apply this philosophy?
Another thing, too, is power, electricity. You know, I was in a situation where I was paying like $1,600 in rent, and I had a little studio, little residential combination studio, residential place. And 2 months in, the landlord comes back with a light bill talking about, hey, I have two properties on this building and you're the only one in this side, so this is your bill. And I'm like, you can't take the electricity out of that. So that prompted me to find a way to get off of her power. So for $125, I went and found, hold on 1 second, I'll be right back. Hello?
Yep, here.
Okay, yeah. So where was I at?
Power bill.
So I went and on Amazon, and I got this little square box. It's a solar generator. And it has two AC-DC power outlets on it and four USB. And you can charge it up either with electricity or with a solar panel. So when that chick talked about, do you have to have all three computers on, blah, 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 I popped up a solar panel and plunked that into my little power box, and I used that to device my power. So little things like that, you can you don't have to spend that much. You can get they're cheaper. You can spend $10 or $12 and get solar devices that will charge your cell phones, your iPads, your tablets. You know, there's little portable chargers that you can have off the grid. See, I come from a homeless background. And so when you're homeless, you know, it's a whole different aspect. Like let's say if you were to go to the store and go running down the street or whatever, and you had some sort of mishap, and you run into the store, some store where you're at, and you say, hey, you know, I need to da da da, let me do this, let me use your phone, let me use your bathroom, they'll let you do that. But if they discern that you're homeless, you ain't going to get no action. And so from that, with that in mind, you're not able to rely. Coming from a background where you're not able to just reach out and shout out and rely on your fellow man, when in any other circumstance you'd be able to do that, you kind of learn to make opportunities out of it. Just seemed like nothing. How I came to my realization and understanding of it, of this millionaire concept, I was in Sacramento, homeless in Sacramento, and you know, the routine, the daily routine was the same. I'd get up, I'd have to go over here to stand in line to get something to eat. Then I'd have to go over here to get a bus ticket or try to get a job interview or whatever. Now it's afternoon. Now I got to think about getting myself back over on this side of town so that I can start standing in line about 5 or 5 o'clock, 5:30, so that I can, number one, eat, and then hopefully eat and then get in line and get a bed. And that's usually what the daily routine is. Mm-hmm. And so one day, as I was walking along my normal routine, there was this lady I used to pass, and she'd be out in her yard, and she'd be raking, pulling up the weeds, sweeping. So, you know, I started asking her, hey, can I help you? Do you need some help? And she would grumble at me, no, get on out of here. But I just kept on asking her, hey, is there something I can do? Can I help out? No, you know, go on out of here. So finally, I stopped asking her. One day, I just stopped. She was sitting down, pulling up some weeds. So I just didn't ask her. I just sat down next to her and started pulling up some weeds. I needed to kill time. I needed something constructive to do, something to and stay safe. So she looked at me and she says, "Well, I'm not gonna pay you." I go, "I'm not asking you for anything, right?" So I kept stopping and helping her. Then one day come along, she hands me half a sandwich. Okay. Another time or two, I come along and I do that. She gives me about $5, $2, $3, $5. Ain't much. Okay. And then I realized I had just created a job for myself, or revenue. Okay. And then that got me thinking. I go, you know, I can create a business like this at any time that I want to, just out of need. So she needed some help, well, maybe and maybe not. And then watch this. So that's how I began to realize that. So watch this. Let's say there's a lady in the church and her husband dies. And she's got diabetes. Maybe she's in a wheelchair. She can't mow the lawn anymore. She needs someone to mow the lawn, take care of the whatever, whatever. She's got her husband left all the equipment in the garage, right? Maybe there's a young family in the church, right? Or maybe some young teenage boys that you can send over there to cut mother's lawn, okay? Mother can't pay them, but what mother can do is say, well, I have all of these tools, and my husband's got this old pickup. You can put the tools in the pickup. I'll lend them both to you. You guys can go out and get some clients and create a lawn care service. Okay? Then you work enough, and then you guys can buy your own equipment and give me mine back. And maybe they can even give her a percentage of the money that they make. Now they've created a business. Boom. Just out of need. You see that? Millionaire thinking. You've given someone a job. You've created opportunity. You solved the problem for someone. Does that make sense?
Yep. well.
So.
I guess you had to rely on your creative imagination.
My mother always says that necessity is the mother of invention. And I don't know about all that, but you're right, creativity. It's all about the opportunity, and you can create opportunity. You don't have to wait for someone to give it to you, and that's part of the problem. We're always waiting for someone to give us something or start something or be the first one. Uh-huh. Yeah. So as a man thinks, so is he. So whatever you're thinking about, that's where your efforts and your action is going to be and your passion is going to be, or it should be. So you want to guard your thoughts, and you want your thoughts to be creative. Uh-huh. Forget about them soap operas. Forget about power. Forget about empire. Forget about Trump. Forget about the impeachment. Focus on some real, true, and genuine things going on around you. And then create opportunities seemingly from nothing. That's millionaire thinking. That will make you an instant millionaire. And then you can create opportunities that's going to generate you money, and it's going to be ownership and building. So right now, I've created I Am Streaming. Mm-hmm. We're creating streaming stations, and that idea is going to come to fruition and generate me a lot of money. My thoughts, just from my thoughts. Does that make sense? It's all in my head, but yeah.
We're going to take a quick break right now. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm.
young girls, they do get weary wearing that same old shaggy dress, yeah, yeah. But when she gets weary, try a little tenderness. You know she's waiting, yep, anticipating for things that she'll never, 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 never possess, yeah, yeah. But while she's there waiting, and without them, try a little tenderness. That's all you gotta do. It's not just sentimental, no, no, no. She had her grief and care. But the soft words, they are spoke so gentle, yeah. It makes it easier, easier to bear, yeah. You won't regret it, no, no. Young girls, they don't forget it.
Train call. Said to tell you you're going to be late behind something he need to see down the way.
So what you telling me? We weak?
Boss, I reached out to Black Donnie.
Okay, spit it out, man. Listen, stop fucking double talking me.
Black Donnie say he ain't having any of it. Say Brother Muzon put a hex on all of us.
What about Peacock?
Peacock went and hired out with some Dominicans.
What about Eggie Mule?
Man, Eggie locked up, caught a nickel with the feds for a pistol.
What about Shorty Boy?
Shorty Boy went and cleaned his old act up. Yeah, I know. Fucked us all up.
What we got?
Soldier you sent that as Cuddy, he gonna work out. But the rest of them dudes, I don't know.
All right, listen, big man. About to earn your fucking keep around here right now. You go out, you get Cuddy, and get the best of the rest, and you put a hurting on Marlo. I want my corners.
All right, look. Me and Slim, we're going to work through the alleys and hit them from the side. I want you to come through here. Slow down through the intersection.
Oh, why don't we just come up this way that we ain't got to worry about crossing no intersection?
Come that way? You putting your driver in the line of fire, man. Think on it. He getting taken out. Car gonna crash. Now, where that put you at?
Besides, you don't want to be shooting across your driver, do you? All right, so come in easy. They ain't gonna be looking for you because we gonna have their full attention.
Now, look, pick your targets, drop them, and move out quick. Who driving me?
I'm under the wheel. All right, you make sure you slow down at the end of the block and toss your weapons.
and get rid of any shell casings that kick back in the car. Police can trace them shits.
Toss the gloves, too, right?
Nah, hold on to them. They gonna have that DNA shit all on them. All
right, look, it's gonna take us some time to get set up, so we need y'all to lay back about 4 or 5 blocks. And when we ready, we gonna hit you on the burner. But y'all hold tight till I call you. You got it?
We gonna handle our end. You just make sure some fucking rope left out there for us.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't want to feel like I'm just some damn decoy.
Damn right about that. We should wait for the call. Man, what if that crew got lookout?
Motherfucker, if we waited, it'd be all over time we get there.
Man, plus, look, man, I'm saying, how's that gonna play with Avon, man? They taking all the credit.
Yo, fellas, strap up.
There go that motherfucker Nene, man. I say we take him.
We should wait for the call.
Man, we wait, he gonna get away, man.
Something about waiting for a fucking phone call.
Last seen Gerard, man, he was racing bullets up on Fayette Street. He appeared to be winning, too.
Look, man, until he shows back up here, we ain't gonna know what happened out there.
I damn sure know one fucking thing for sure. Two of our people talked, and we ain't got shit to show for it.
Man, police gonna be real heavy on this, man. I say we slow down, take our time to build our muscle up.
No, I ain't got no more motherfucking time, man. When the work comes, this boy Marlo punking me, what I'ma look like? I'm gonna go do this shit my damn self.
Nah, man, you just this minute got home. Your name come up in a murder beef, man, they gonna pull your parole. Let me take care of this.
We was thinking, man, me and Cuddy, you know what I'm saying, we can hit them and them ourselves, man. That way, won't be no fuck-ups.
Look, you two niggas get on it, man. And get it right.
My name is Burke Hedges, author of the best-selling book, The Parable of the Pipeline. I open my book with a story about Pablo and Bruno, who take two very different paths in their quest for financial independence. What you're about to see is the delightful animated story of their adventure. So, sit back, relax, and enjoy the life-changing lessons in The Parable of the Pipeline.
Far away, in a small village, near a beautiful valley, lived two friends, Pablo and Bruno. They were both young and dreamed of a better life for themselves. They'd often discuss their dreams about how they would become the most successful men in the village. They weren't afraid of hard work, and they searched for opportunities to help realize their goals and achieve their dreams. One day, an opportunity presented itself. The mayor of the village decided to hire two people to bring water from a spring up on the mountain, across the valley, back down to the village. They were to be paid based on the amount of water delivered to the village. Bruno and Pablo enthusiastically got to work. Every day, from morning till evening, they carried buckets to and from the spring. They worked hard, carrying water to the village. In the evening, they'd return home with their day's wages. Bruno was satisfied with his work and the money he earned. He was sure that with this work, he could achieve his dreams. Bruno thought that to increase his wages, he could use bigger buckets to bring more water each trip. He believed with a larger income, he would soon be able to buy a cow and the house that he dreamed about. Now, Pablo was not satisfied. At the end of the day, his back and hands ached, and he was exhausted. He was looking for an easier way to earn more. One day, an idea occurred to Pablo. He imagined building a pipeline to deliver the water from the mountain spring to the village. With this pipeline, he could get more water to the village without carrying buckets back and forth from the spring to the village. Soon, he got very excited about his idea and began to plan. Pablo, of course, shared his idea with his friend Bruno and asked him to join with him to work on and help build the pipeline. Bruno thought the idea was crazy. All Bruno could think about was what his money could buy today and how to get it quicker. He felt that building a pipeline would slow him down and delay him in achieving his goals. Instead, Bruno got bigger buckets and went more often back and forth fetching water. He was sure that with this method, he could make more money. Pablo decided to build the pipeline on his own. He understood that it would not be easy to build, and it would take time to complete the pipeline. Pablo knew that it could take several years to finish, but he set his mind on his goal. Every day, he worked and carried water like before. But on weekends and during his spare time, he worked hard to dig in the rocky soil and build his pipeline. In the first month, there was little to show for his work. Bruno and the villagers laughed and teased him. They called him Pablo the Pipeline Man. During this time, Bruno's income doubled. He already bought a cow and a bigger house. His lifestyle changed. He now spent time after work in the bar, enjoying his hard-earned wages from delivering water. What Bruno didn't realize was that his body was starting to stoop from carrying heavy buckets every day. His face looked worn and his body tired. Soon, he began to carry less and less water due to the wear and tear on his body. Month after month, Pablo worked. Soon a year passed, and then a second year. Finally, Pablo finished his pipeline. He now used his pipeline to deliver water to the village. Instead of carrying buckets, Pablo was now earning more money than ever before. The water continued flowing to the village while Pablo wasn't working. While he slept and ate, the water flowed. Pablo was happy and proud of his insight, persistence, and hard work. Now his income flowed as long as the water flowed through his pipeline. The story of Bruno and Pablo is a reflection of life. Their jobs symbolize what most people do to earn money. Bruno gets his money using buckets. He goes back and forth, carrying his buckets from the spring to the village in exchange for money. To increase his income, he either has to go more frequently to the spring or to use larger buckets. It's common in real life to increase our income by working harder. For example, working overtime or getting a second job. We also increase the size of our buckets by accepting a higher paying position, which often includes spending more time on the job. Most of us exchange time for money like Bruno. We know that every person has only 24 hours in the day, and that it's not possible to use all our time to work. The most difficult time comes when we can no longer exchange time for money due to age, health, or other reasons. Then, our income stops. Now let's review what Pablo did. Very wisely, Pablo did not exchange all of his time for limited income, but he used some of his time to build a pipeline. He knew that the pipeline would bring ongoing income as long as the water flowed. An ongoing income that multiplied the time he worked each day. Pablo knew that someday, maybe because of age or health, he would no longer be able to exchange his available time for money. Pablo knew that if he could make his idea of a pipeline work, then he only has to do the hard work of building the pipeline. After the pipeline was completed, Pablo was able to monitor and maintain the flow of water to ensure that his income will continue. Pablo has shown us that to earn an income, we don't always have to directly exchange time for money. There really are better ways. How about you? Are you still like Bruno, who directly exchanges time for money? Or do you want to be like Pablo, building and maintaining a pipeline for ongoing income? If you are interested in the idea of building your own pipeline, contact the person who lent you this presentation. You can start building your pipeline today.
Okay, that was, I think you can pick up some millionaire philosophy in the story of Bruno and person could have stepped away there. Okay. All right, while we're waiting on Robin here, let's see if, her mic closed. Oh, boy. Okay, well, let's try it. Let's see if she's going to call back in.
Thank you. At Jiffy Lube, we car about cars. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. That's why we've been taking car off business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll car for your car like we car for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.